Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Haiti's huge needs. It's 1 month since the devastating earthquake that hit Haiti, and we take a fresh look at the plight of the afflicted population with the help of a doctor who went there to help the injured and a Haitian artist who describes the long-standing problems besetting his homeland. And Vatican Centuries. Listen to the 28th episode in our historical series that looks at the lives and legends of the people and places that went into the making of the Vatican.
Sauve la vie moi, la misère moi y est.
Prayer vigils have been held in Haiti to mark the one-month anniversary of the catastrophic earthquake that hit the Caribbean nation. And in this programme, I'd like to take a fresh look at the ongoing plight of the Haitian people in the wake of this disaster. The quake that struck Haiti on January the 12th has killed more than 230,000 people and injured around 300,000 others. An estimated 3 million people have been left homeless or needing help. With the rainy season now approaching, there is increasing concern in the capital Port-au-Prince that the lack of tents and temporary shelters for the homeless could lead to the outbreak of disease. In the days immediately after the quake struck, rescue and aid workers from around the world rushed to Haiti to deliver relief supplies and lend a hand to the stricken population. Among those who answered the pleas for help was Dr. Robert Wally, founder of MartyrCare, the Catholic healthcare organisation that aims to reduce maternal mortality and injuries and protect the lives of babies. Dr. Wally spent 2 weeks in Haiti helping the missionaries of charity Sisters, who had been overwhelmed at their centre in Port-au-Prince by severely injured adults and children desperately needing medical help. On his arrival, he found himself having to treat patients with severe trauma injuries without the use of anaesthetic drugs. He also spoke about the overlooked plight of pregnant women, who amidst the chaos and devastation of the capital were often being forced to deliver their babies on the open ground without medical care.
Everything was about emergency, trying to cope with the terrible injuries everybody had. And people seem to forget that motherhood doesn't conveniently stop because there is a crisis, a catastrophe. It continues, so that all the emphasis was on relief and trauma and so on, but nothing for maternal health. So if you've lost your home or you've lost your hospital, which they have, there's nowhere to deliver but where you lie. And so the suffering for them is even more than the suffering for ordinary people.
And tell us a bit, as you sort of went about and saw the devastation in the streets such as they are or remain, what were some of the most shocking things that you saw?
Well, two things. I think you saw the actual devastation in downtown. It's flattened. It's just piles of concrete. And the interesting thing was the guide we had was a young woman who was familiar. She knew it's a hometown. She couldn't find her way around because everything had changed. There were no landmarks anymore. That was the first thing. And then trying to deal with the patients that were coming in. I'm an obstetrician gynecologist, but I had to turn myself into a traumatologist, an orthopaedic guy, because most of them crushed fractures. Many of the injuries were enormous, soft tissue injuries. Gangrene.
And they had gangrene, presumably, because they hadn't been treated.
Absolutely, and they were infected. So you had to debride them. That means you have to remove the dead tissue. And all you have in your ears after that is from the little babies to the oldest person screaming as you had to try and do the best you could.
Did you not have
anesthesia? There was no anesthesia, no. And the gorgeous thing was that the children were in agony while you do it. As soon as you bandaged it and you made it easy, they smiled at you. and there was a thank you. And that's what struck me about everybody who came in, and they didn't complain. Some of the young people as well had terrible injuries, but they didn't make a noise. They didn't complain or anything. They seemed to bear them with great fortitude, if I may say so, because I'm talking about their pain and not mine.
But it must have been agony at times.
Absolutely, absolutely. And many of them, we couldn't have had to move them on. But there was also the agony for mothers who had to make a decision as to whether the child they had would have to have a limb amputated. In the immediate aftermath, that's what the surgeons were having to do, removal of the limb, because there was just no hope. If you left it, it would just get gang and they die. And so we looked at that, but then we looked at trying to see what maternity services were. Interestingly enough, I met the nuncio purely by chance, the apostolic nuncio, who is now the administrator of the St. Francis de Sales Hospital. We went and saw that hospital, very difficult to get into it because the roads are so narrow because of the concrete. When we got in there, we found the whole of the obstetrical maternity unit, which was three floors, which had the maternity ward for mothers, it had the delivery rooms, and then it had the nursery, had collapsed. And everybody was still inside, and that was after a week.
The stench then, wherever you went.
The smell of death is something I'd never experienced, even as a doctor of 40 years. I'd never experienced that, and that was the very difficult things. And not only the sounds, but it was the smell. It was that everybody was going about their business, as it were, the doctors and the nurses, and the patients were lying there in all of this kind of sort of chaos, but they were trying to make order out of chaos and very kind of gentle about it. They were having to work very fast, and there was no kind of, not so much the doctor-patient relationship, but you were having to work hard and they accepted that and you were just having to cope with what you saw. So our need now is to try and rebuild that particular hospital, because life, motherhood goes on, it doesn't stop.
Now, as you said, I mean, did you actually see many pregnant women or women who'd just given birth? And what sort of conditions were they doing it?
Well, they, as I said, when you've lost your home and most of the hospitals, there's nowhere to go. So you have your baby where you are lying. If it's in one of the makeshift camps that have been established all over the city, tens of thousands in these camps, that you had to lie on the ground and have your baby. And we were told that they had just delivered in the open with everybody, without dignity. As I said, with some kind of feeling that there was no stable down there, just where you lay in the open. No dignity, you know, people going by, no help. Obviously no medical doctors or obstetricians and no midwives. So you delivered, and that's why it's an urgency to look after them.
Did you get to talk at all at some length with some of these people, you know, these survivors? And what sort of struck you most about them? Did they make any remarks that really sort of stuck in your mind?
No, we went with a priest to the largest slum called Cité Soleil, and it's been badly damaged. It's a squatter area where people just come in the village and set up, and it's huge, largest slum in Western Hemisphere. We went there, and funnily enough, you got the sense that people were trying to get semblance of order. So they were cooking out in the streets. They were bathing their kids in buckets out in the street. They had rigged up a little tent, partly in the daytime because of the sun, it was so hot. One of the things that struck us was the look of, it was just a blank look on their faces. And as the priest pointed out, not being cynical or anything, he said, you know why these people are like this? Sometimes they look happy. And he answered his question after a pause, and he said, because they've got nothing left to lose. And that's the whole tragedy. It's such a poor country, and this on top of it. And as you mentioned earlier, the previous hurricane and the floods, it's a wonder that
They've had more than their fair share of disasters.
Yeah, and you can keep your sanity in all of that. But then we saw all the work that had been done there over the years by this particular priest. Schools he'd built, six schools. There was a huge dispensary, all now either collapsed with children inside or now got to be pulled down. And even the missionaries of charity who we stayed with, who are doing a fantastic job feeding people, they've lost three-story buildings, which have got to come, they're unstable, they've got to come down. So the reconstruction there is going to be long-term.
As you said, it was already the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere before this, and as we've just been discussing, had more than its fair share of natural disasters in recent years. I mean, how resilient are the population?
I think they must be hugely resilient, but I think, as people were pointing out, there has to be a kind of a fundamental change of heart amongst the people. They must demand better. They must want to have better of their country and are better organised. And see, there was no sort of agencies to really deal with the situation as it arose. So it had to wait for days before the international community came. And the United States came in. And I must say, we saw a lot of troops around in the streets, the American troops and young people, young men and women. They came with us when they found out we were with the Mother Teresa sisters. And when they came to the compound, they heard there was a nursery with 80 children in it, now in sort of makeshift accommodation because their building had been damaged. And the officer looked at it and he came back and he said, "Sister, I'll be back in 2 hours." And he came back 2 hours with a truck full of baby milk, full of meals and food, and says, "Sister, you want diesel? I'll be back tomorrow with diesel." So there was this kind of
amazing solidarity.
And the people liked it because they created order, but not with any sort of violence or intimidation. Moving around, getting the aid out is extremely difficult. Sometimes we're hearing criticism now that it's not
being done. There's always criticism in these cases, though.
You can't move. You can't get a truck.
Yes.
You know, there's no cars available.
You talked there about the children. Of course, there's going to be many, many orphans. And there's also been a lot of publicity given to the case of those supposed orphans that were supposedly kidnapped by these American missionaries. I mean, is this a real problem?
The sisters and everybody were very, very concerned about children being taken from the streets. And I know one that we'd sent down, she had a fractured leg. We couldn't find her. And then everybody was worried. And I said, "Sister, they're not going to take a child with a broken leg." But these people who came around from the States, they're either stupid, because you don't go into any country in the world, it doesn't matter what situation is, and just pick up a whole load of children and decide you can leave the country with them. That's the doubt that's in my mind, that why are they that stupid? I don't think so. But are children disappearing? I think they are. I think there would be the evil people who would come and want to take children out of something supposedly for good intentions, but to use them. That's kind of more tragedy on top of it.
How is Haiti going to recover from this national... It's going to take decades, isn't it? Do you think it can ever fully recover? I mean, can something good come out of so much tragedy?
If there's a change of heart of the people must be the ones that make the country. Just one little incident I saw with the people. We were parked along the side of the road and just sitting there, and this young lad, I suppose he must have been 10 or 11, came up there and he was wanting a drink, you see. So I had a bottle of water and I had a packet of chips that was in there. So I gave them, and he had a couple of buddies. Do you know what he did? He went over and shared it with them. He could have just walked off with that or ran off with it and enjoyed it for himself. No, he shared. There's a lot of that. We saw another young man looking after his mother in our mini hospital. She got a bad injury. And then we found what he was doing was going and looking after the other people because there wasn't enough staff. He would get one old gentleman up and massage his legs. He had a broken arm and a broken leg, massaging him because he got stiff lying there. He would come and give him water, or he'd take him to the bathroom. Those simple kind of gestures showed that there was a real gentleness in the people.
I was talking to Dr. Robert Wally, founder of MartyrCare, about his recent visit to Haiti. As we just heard, gentleness and generosity are two of the key characteristics of the people of Haiti that have come to the fore as they struggle to get by in the wake of this devastating quake. But how do the Haitian people feel about this tragedy? And do they believe their homeland can rise to the daunting challenge of reconstruction? Many are asking, why, for instance, did this earthquake in Haiti, measuring 7.0 on the Richter scale, cause such massive destruction, compared to quakes of similar strength that have hit California in recent decades with far fewer consequences? Patrick Bouchard is a Catholic Haitian artist now living in Britain, who set up an artistic centre in his hometown of Jacmel, the fourth largest city in Haiti. He says the lack of good governance and proper building regulations in his homeland helped to magnify the extent of the devastation caused by January's quake.
One of the major problems is a third world country with very little governance. So there are certain things that are very anarchic in a way. For instance, construction. We don't really have building codes. Anybody can build, you know, whether you're an architect or not, or whether you're an engineer or not. So a lot of people do their own building. So necessarily, you know, everybody's also trying to cut cost. So they're not necessarily the soundest buildings that are built there. So that in itself. At the same time, what they did, which was wrong, is they centralized everything in the capital in Port-au-Prince. So that's why Haiti has a population of 10 million plus, and you have over 2 million people living in the capital. Whereas they should have decentralized it, and I think that's what they're going to try to do throughout the country now. So by having centralized this like that, you have a lot of people from the countryside coming to looking for work in Port-au-Prince. And a lot of squatters, and they build these shanty towns. They build them on dry riverbeds. They build them on cliff sides, you know, which is not very strong. And a lot of these have totally disappeared in the earthquake. And I think the huge numbers of people, you know, that have died like that. So it's lack of governments, really. And the government is been plagued by a lot of problems, gangs, the drug trafficking over there. So, and also the elite in Port-au-Prince, you know, the commercial and economic elite, is very happy making its millions and not really reinvesting in the country and not caring about the people. I think pretty much since Haiti's independence, Haiti's paid the price, I think, for being the first black republic in the world. And is nobody recognized it at the beginning. And it's still paying the price in a sense where, you know, the people, nobody cares about the people, you know. And that's what I tried to do with the social work that I did in Haiti, is care about the real people in Haiti. You know, there's so many other interests, whether it's foreign businesses, whether it's the commercial elite and all that. And always the people come last. So, and because of the corruption and the lack of structure and organization and governments, even though there's a lot of aid that's gone to Haiti, a lot of it has been a waste of time. And it's not really geared at making it a sustainable for the future. Because the subsidies to the U.S. agricultural market, you know, it's cheaper to import sugar and rice and all these staples from the U.S. than to produce it. So we've become from an agricultural country with a huge amount of erosion and deforestation, but still we were an agricultural country in the 70s and 80s, and now we're probably at 90%, 99% importing country on all the goods that we produce. So that's wrong also. And so Haiti's problem is not just now in the earthquake. Hopefully some of these things will be rectified now. But, you know, it's other people's agendas also.
But despite those long-standing problems besetting Haiti, does Patrick now see an opportunity there to start afresh and put things right?
It is certainly an opportunity, but at the same time, it's such a monumental challenge that, and also it takes cooperation, you know, from the different countries, from the international community, whether we will have that cooperation, whether that reconstruction and aid will be to the benefit of the people of Haiti, that remains to be seen.
Patrick goes on to outline his personal hope for Haiti in the wake of this disaster.
Well, my personal hope is first of all to get through the first stage of survival. The second is, hopefully, you know, I keep praying that the different donor countries will do the right thing. It is a huge opportunity because it's an opportunity to start all over again. But then again, where are we going to find the funds to do that? Because it's going to need billions and billions of pounds to be able to reconstruct. I mean, if you think of, let's say you have probably 3 million people homeless with nothing and a place with 75% unemployment. How do you do that? So the challenge is huge, but I'm hoping that the best interests of Haiti will be taken into consideration and the Haitian people, and that something will be done for the people. And I also hope that Haitians will develop a stronger conscience to be more nationalistic and care more about the country.
Religious faith is very strong amongst the Haitian people, as Patrick explains.
Faith is huge in Haiti. They always say that Haiti is the battleground between God and the devil, in a sense. Just about every religion is there. Voodoo is the primary religion, which people have been trying to subdue for quite a while since the beginning. But I think in third world countries, especially when life is very difficult, people have a lot more faith because their future or even their present is not in their own hands. They feel very powerless about the way they can direct their lives. I mean, they have a saying in Haiti, let's say if you say someone, I'll see you tomorrow, and they'll say, si bon Dieu veut, they'll say, God willing. Because for them, every day, basically what happens is God's will. So faith is huge there. I think that the poorer you are, the more difficult your life is, the more that you need to hang on to a higher power to be able to go through life and go through the days. So faith is a huge aspect. And I think even more so now when you have a catastrophe like that, I think that it really, to keep your sanity, just to keep your sanity, I think is your faith is what keeps you going, you know, because if you try to rationalize it, it really doesn't make any sense. If you try to look at a positive aspect from this, there is none. It's only loss of life, it's only pain and suffering. So it's very difficult. I think it's kind of shaken my faith a little bit. But in Haiti, I think it will make the faith stronger. When you have something like this that you can't explain why, you know, this has happened, there has to be a higher purpose for it, and you have to trust in it.
That was the voice of Haitian artist Patrick Bouchard, interviewed by the Catholic Diocese of Clifton, Bristol, in Western England. We now broadcast the 28th chapter or episode in our ongoing historical series, where we look at the lives and legends of the people and places that went into the making of the Vatican throughout the centuries. The programme is written by Jill Bevilacqua and produced by Sean Patrick Lovett. Today's episode takes us back to the beginning of the 16th century, and we learn what prompted Julius II to institute the Swiss Guards, and why he decided upon the demolition of the old St. Peter's Basilica.
Chapter 28, Might and Magnificence.
The modern era was fast approaching. Life no longer moved at a leisurely pace, conditioned by the seasons. Time had become precious.
As the Renaissance advanced, the alarm clock, first made in 1410 by Brunelleschi, was joined by the wristwatch, a logical development in an age which celebrated the individual.
Information and knowledge were becoming ever more rapidly diffused. By the beginning of the 16th century, the print shops of Europe numbered 1,000.
At the turn of the century, the three men who were to dominate the art of their age were in Florence: Leonardo da Vinci, Michelangelo, and young Raphael of Urbino.
Advances in medicine and science continued. In Rome, in the year 1500, was Nicholas Copernicus, who lectured very successfully on mathematics.
Studying Greek in Oxford was Erasmus of Rotterdam, the most famous humanist of the time and amused chronicler of men's follies.
Discovery and colonization were flourishing. In April 1500, Pedro Cabral claimed Brazil for Portugal. The following year, Columbus discovered Nicaragua.
In the Jubilee year of 1500, it's recorded that 200,000 people crowded into St. Peter's Square to receive the Pope's Easter blessing. But the Borgias' time was running out.
On the feast of Saints Peter and Paul in the year 1500, the ceiling of the Pope's dining room collapsed, and Alexander VI narrowly escaped with his life. It seemed a bad omen.
In the August of 1503, the city of Rome was hot and humid, and malaria was rife. When a large Borgia cardinal died, Pope Alexander VI, who was stout himself, was heard to observe, "This month is a bad one for fat people." And so it was. On the 18th, he died of a fever and was hastily buried the next day. His son, Cesare, sent his men to lock the papal apartments and carry off the treasure, which was hidden in Alexander's study.
No one thought to carry off another, far more valuable treasure, displayed in St. Peter's in full view of all and with no protection whatsoever. Michelangelo's Pietà, completed 4 years earlier, a commission from a French cardinal.
Alexander's successor was Julius II, called the greatest pope since Innocent III and the saviour of the papacy. And if he's celebrated for his stormy relationship with Michelangelo, he's surely remembered more than anything else for one massive enterprise, the rebuilding of St. Peter's.
It was to take over a century, and almost every major architect in 16th century Rome had a hand in designing it.
But it was Julius who took the decision to demolish the old church. After 12 centuries of life, and despite constant renovation, it was in a shaky state. And now the south wall threatened to collapse.
Julius called in the architect Bramante. For years, the two of them had been deliberating and had produced a project of unprecedented splendor. Now the world would see what man could do for the greater glory of God.
On February the 21st, 1506, demolition work began. 2 months later, Julius laid the first stone of the new building with his own hands. Paris de Grassis, papal master of ceremonies under Julius II, left a diary in which he describes the event.
Saturday of Easter week, 1506. The Pope said he wanted to lay the first stone today of one of the four columns which are to sustain the choir, or rather the canopy, over the high altar of the Basilica of the Prince of the Apostles. A road had been set up with planks to allow for the descent down to the base of the column. But having seen the width and the depth, many people, including the Pope, feared to fall. So the Pope called out to those who were near the edge to move away. Not one cardinal went down with the Pope, apart from the two cardinal deacons who were in attendance. Some of the masons came down with us, and a goldsmith carrying 12 newly minted coins, or rather medals, the size of a mass host and the width of the blade of a common pencil sharpener. On one side of the medal was the image of Pope Julius with the inscription, Julius Ligurian, Sovereign Pontiff, third year of his pontificate, 1506. And on the other, there was the drawing of the church he wished to build, with these words, Installation of the Basilica of the Apostles, Peter and Paul, for Julius II, Sovereign Pontiff, and underneath, the word Vatican. Two of these coins were of gold, and the others of imitation gold, in a terracotta bowl.
Julius II had ascended the pontifical throne after one of the shortest conclaves ever, a single day. Even as a cardinal, he had enjoyed great prestige, and he was elected pope, we are told, without simony and amidst general applause. His reign was to be one of the most extraordinary in history.
Julius was the nephew of Sixtus IV and had an intimate knowledge of the workings of the papacy and the extent of papal authority. He believed that before reforming the church, he must guarantee the independence and security of the papal states, which on his accession were disintegrating. And with the French in Milan and the Spanish in Naples, Rome was in a vice.
Julius acted. He signed up Swiss mercenaries to drive the French from Italy, and in the bitter winter of 1510, donned armor himself and took to the field.
That a pope should have led an army into battle shocks and surprises the modern mind. But historians have excused Julius, explaining that he had no choice at a time when a man in Italy was forced to be either hammer or anvil, and when personality was the only key to power.
Julius had personality. He was a restless, strong-willed man with a powerful, original nature. Anger and goodwill alike came to the surface, and the Pontefice Terribile commanded universal respect.
Julius II was no scholar, but he supported the universities and collected a fine library. He patronized the arts for the glorification of the church and to make the center of Christendom the envy of all.
Rome is full of memories of Julius II, but perhaps the warrior pope would like best the living memorial familiar to every visitor to Vatican City, the Swiss Guards, a colorful reminder of a man who left his mark.
The program was written and presented by Jill Bevilacqua and produced by Sean Patrick Lovett.
Well, that's all from Vatican Radio's English program for today, but we'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow. Laudato Jesus Christus.